You know, over my time in being a pastor in the Church of God, I have had the opportunity, as I've mentioned before, to be on several Challenger young adult hiking programs, four of them to be exact. And to go along with that, I've been on five Camp Sequoia extended session backpacking trips, starting my sixth coming up this July, when we will head back to Catalina Island for a third time with a group of teens. It's interesting when you go through Challenger and the extended session, because what we do with the participants at the end of the day, we are on our way to a particular journey where we have started. We've broken that particular hike up into a number of days, and when we come to the end of that day, as we're sitting around the campfire, or in the case of 2012 in Colorado, when there was a fire ban and we were sitting around while the rain was pouring down, we couldn't have a fire. We would discuss the events of the prior of that day and what lessons we could learn. Well, in Colorado in 2012, the lesson was very clear. It'd be nice to be able to have a fire right now and dry everything out. But it's interesting when you would go through some of the events of the day and some of those hiking sessions that we had on Challenger or the extended session, because as we would debrief and go through the lessons learned, we would begin to understand the spiritual principles that would go along with it. I often think about those trips, and I wonder for a moment what the conversation would have been like every evening for Israel for 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. You have to believe that at certain points they would sit down that evening, perhaps around a roaring fire, and ask the question, haven't we seen this rock before? Again, I think I've mentioned before previous years that if you take a look at the ultimate destination from where they were to where they needed to go, it was no more than about 483 miles, I believe, roughly. And if you were to take that based upon what you could knowingly hike in a day, it shouldn't have taken more than about 60 days to get to the promised land. But it took them 40 years. But again, I ask the question, if they had had a debrief every evening, would it have made a difference? Would it have made a difference for them? You know, the history of ancient Israel's 40-year wandering through the wilderness gives us tremendous fodder for multiple lessons. I'm sure you have heard sermons about that in your history in the church. We're going to go through some of those lessons today, as you're going to find, but I'm going to take them from the premise of a minister who already talked about these lessons to God's people after they occurred. Now, I'm not talking about a minister in the 21st century or even the 20th century of God's church. I'm going to take you back to the Apostle Paul, because he spoke about these lessons in the wilderness as Israel was wandering. And it's interesting to note that the lessons that he was describing to Corinth at the time were, again, lessons that were not just for Corinth, but they are lessons that have an application for us today in the 21st century. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. If you have one of those little dealy bobs, that's what I call it, in your Bible, you can stick that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, because we're going to be coming back to here. If you have an electronic device that has your scriptures, well, aren't you special? I only say that because I don't get up here with an iPad, because I just don't know. Anyways, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, let's begin here in verse 1, and let's take a look here at what the Apostle Paul was talking about. And again, we're going to skip through here a little bit, and we're going to come back and pick up the lessons. But let's begin here in verse 1 to see what we're talking about. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 1, he says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, Jesus Christ living in them. And all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness." So right away we have the inference here that Paul is making that, look, these are our forefathers. They passed through that Red Sea. They again came through with, again, the rock, the food, the spiritual food they needed, everything they needed in order to make it. But then he says in verse 5 that God was not well pleased with most of them. And he says their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Let's drop down to verse 10. I'm sorry, verse 11. Verse 11, he says, "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." So Paul is drawing a correlation here. He says, just because it happened to ancient Israel, remember he's speaking to Corinth, just because it happened to ancient Israel, don't think for a moment that the spiritual lesson that we are going to go through or that I'm explaining to you can't happen to you here in Corinth. But by extension, we come to understand that it's not just Corinth that he was speaking to, because the message that he was giving was timeless, and it is for us today. Paul is going to take tremendous care here to speak to the past and how it applied to the church of God at Corinth. I would submit to you that his application has application to us today. The circumstances may have been a little bit different back in Corinth when he gave this particular or wrote this particular letter, but we find in the 21st century that all of what he talked about has, again, examples for us today and application for us today. The title for the sermon this afternoon is Wilderness Lessons in the 21st Century. Wilderness lessons in the 21st century. Now, we're going to see here that there are five lessons that Paul gave to Corinth. We're going to take a look at the lesson that ancient Israel had to learn. We're going to see how it was applied by Paul to the church of God at Corinth, and then ask the question, what is the lesson for us today? That's the trifecta. If you're going to the racetrack, you just won the grand prize. You picked all three horses. Congratulations. You cannot go home yet and spend your money. You must wait and listen to these five lessons. What are those lessons? We're going to find those five lessons. Let's go back here to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 now. And let's, excuse me, let's pick up the first lesson that we find here in chapter 10. We find it in verse 6. Notice the statement here. "Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." So what is the lesson here? The lesson that we are trying to get across is lusting after evil things. Now what was Paul talking about? Again, we're going to find that these five lessons that he gave specifically had reference to something that ancient Israel went through. So he's not just sort of grabbing these lessons out of midair and saying, you know, oh, this applies to Corinth. He's going to show the examples, or we're going to see the examples with ancient Israel. So what was he specifically talking about? He seemed to be thinking about something here. What was it he was thinking about with regard to ancient Israel? Okay, hold your place here. Let's go over to Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. We're going to find out specifically what he's talking about. What was this lusting after evil things? What was it that Israel was doing? What was he referring to? Let's notice Numbers chapter 11 beginning here in verse 4. God is beginning to see that there's a skirmish, that there's something that's going on here, and there's this crying out that's happening with the children of Israel. Let's pick it up here in verse 4. It said, "Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving." Intense craving. "So the children of Israel also wept again and said, 'Who will give us meat to eat?'" Now you think about that just for a moment. That particular verse itself should give you a lesson in terms of the just emotional immaturity of the people. These are grown people. Who in their right mind at lunch today was sitting there going, "Oh, I'm so hungry. I'm craving meat, and I have these cheese and crackers. I want bread. I want pie. I want cake." I mean, this is, can I just say it? It's a little idiotic. It's emotionally immature. I mean, was that really the problem here? Crying because they didn't have what they wanted. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat?" Well, there we have the clue. We're sick and tired of this manna. We've boiled it, we've baked it, we've sauteed it, we've barbecued it, we've done everything we can with it. We've made casseroles. We've made sandwiches out of it. We're sick of it. We want meat, man. I want a nice filet, medium rare. We remember, verse 5, the fish that we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Of course, they didn't remember the fact that they were slaves and they were beaten and forced to make bricks, you know, double quota, half the straw, whatever it might have been. They forgot that part of it. All they remembered is, man, we had a smorgasbord there. It was like being on a cruise ship. We had whatever we want, whenever we wanted. We want to eat 3 a.m, man, we can have it all. Now we got to have this stinking manna. Verse 6. But now our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. I mean, you begin to sense here that just, I mean, they are overcome and wrought with this emotional distress. They were lusting after meat. God had given them everything they needed, but it wasn't enough. They craved, they lusted after something else. Remember how good we had it in Egypt? Remember how great it was? Oh, they remembered the food, but they didn't remember the other part of it. For them, they were happy. It was 3 hots and a cot. We're good. 3 hot meals and a cot to sleep on. We're good. They didn't remember the bitter, bitter affliction they were under. Verse 11. So Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you afflicted your servant, and why have I not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I beget them that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom as a guardian carries a nursing children to the land which you swore to their fathers'?" He's not happy. He's not happy. "I've taken you out of where you were at, and now you're complaining about something you don't have. You're lusting after something you don't have." You don't want to do that with God, because now the rest of the story is he's going to make you pay in ways you just don't even want to think about. Verse 18, he brings the quail. Then you shall say, verse 18, "Say to the people, 'Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, Who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat.'" Not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5, nor 10, nor 20 days, but for a whole month. I got meat right up to here, and now it's starting to come through my nostrils, as it says here in verse 20. "But for the whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have despised the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, 'Why did we ever come out of Egypt? Why did we ever come out of this slavery?'" They lusted after something they didn't have. They didn't realize what they had, and they lusted after something they did not have. And God said, "Okay, I can play that game too." And you're going to learn a lesson here. You're going to learn a lesson. Verse 31. "Now a wind went out from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea and left them fluttering near the camp, about a day's journey on this side and about a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the surface of the ground. And the people stayed up all that day, all night, and all the next day and gathered the quail." I mean, 2 cubits above the ground, I think a cubit's about 18 inches, if I'm right, so it's about 3 feet of quail. That's a stinking lot of quail. If you're a hunter, that's a lot of quail. That's what you want. You're going to fill your bird tags pretty quick, right? That's a lot of quail. "And the people stayed up all day, all night, and the next day, and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. But while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. So he called the name of that place Kibroth Hevatah, because there they buried the people who had yielded to craving." They got what they wanted. But God said, "You didn't do according to what I told you to do. You did not, again, take what I had given to you." The people were craving meat. This seems to be what Paul was talking about when he was talking to them back in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Let's go back there now to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. He was talking about this lust that they had. And again, an understanding and realization as he starts this whole conversation with, we're talking about ancient Israel. And so from his writing, we have to believe that this is what he was talking about. Now, what is the point here that we're talking about when he says we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted? Is it wrong to desire meat? No. What we find with ancient Israel is it's wrong to desire evil things. They were not given meat for a reason. They were being given, again, what God knew they needed. What Paul was referring to Corinth and the church of God in Corinth as was about the evil of lusting after something. If you take a look historically, Corinth was historically an evil center. It was an evil city. You know, we talk about certain cities in the United States or in the world today that we might consider, well, that's just a hotbed of evil activity or wrong activity or unrighteous activity or ungodly activity. None of them, I would say, had anything on Corinth. When you go back in history and you take a look at how Corinth was incredibly evil. There were multiple temples used to worship different gods in Corinth. Paul is telling them not to lust after the things of the world, wanting to fit in and be attracted to the things of the world. Here they were in this environment. Everybody was going about and doing their own thing and lusting after these things in this city. And Paul's saying, don't be like Israel. They lusted after something they did not have. And they paid the price. I'm going to go with rapid fire through some scriptures. You don't have time, again, to turn to them. You can write them down. With regards to lusting after things, notice Matthew 5, verse 28. Again, I will read it to you. You just need to write it down if you're taking notes. Matthew 5, verse 28. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. That is as applicable back in Corinth as it is for us today. You see the correlation here? We're talking about a lesson in the 21st century. Romans 13 and verse 13. Romans 13, verse 13. Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy. Applicable to Corinth, applicable to Rome, applicable to us today. James 4, verse 2. You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot attain. You fight in war. You do not have because you do not ask. James was thought to be the first possible pastor of the church in Jerusalem. I don't know if he was writing this at that particular time. I have no idea. But again, you get a sense. It was just as applicable to us today as it was to them back then. 2 Peter 1, verses 3 and 4. 2 Peter verses 1, verse 3 and 4, as His divine power has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of Him who called us by glory and virtue, by which have been given to us exceedingly great and precious promises, that through these you may be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. So there's a contradiction or, again, a dichotomy of terms here where he's talking about the one, which has to do with the divine nature which we are partakers of, and he's saying we have escaped the lust that exists in the world today. One final one, 1 John chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. 1 John chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. John said the following. He said, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. There's the trifecta. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And the world is passing away, verse 17, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. Paul was addressing Corinth for what happened and occurred when they said, we want meat. We're lusting after meat. We're craving the meat. We had it so good in Egypt. Take us back there. Paul was addressing Corinth by telling him, don't be involved with the evil that is around you in the city with which you live. What is the lesson for us in the 21st century? We need to guard against the cravings of the world and lusting after things of the world. There are many of them out there. As I said before, we could take a look at any major city in the world today, and we can say there are ungodly, unrighteous things absolutely about it, some worse than others. But it had nothing on Corinth. The spiritual application for us and what Paul was talking about here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is to guard against cravings of the world and lusting after the things of the world. Let's move now to the second lesson that he gave to Corinth that applies again to us today. We're back in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Notice verse 7. He says, and do not become idolaters as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. What is he referring to here? Again, he seems to be speaking about a specific event that took place with ancient Israel. What was it? Let's go over to Exodus chapter 32. In Exodus chapter 32, we're going to find the event of the golden calf. Now, this one is interesting, and I think you'll see what I mean as we come to the end and the application for us today. Exodus chapter 32, and notice beginning in verse 1. Exodus 32 and verse 1, he says, now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain. Now, let's stop there for a moment. Do you not think that God kind of had this planned? He was going to test the patience of the people. Moses said, I'm going to go up, and I'm going to come back. Wait for me. Now, God knows all. He sees all. He hears all. He obviously heard Moses. He said, well, let's see what's going to happen if I delay you a little bit. I have to believe that was all part of the plan. Again, no idea. I'm just stepping in and saying, surmising, I think that might be what it was. When the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, come make us gods that shall go before us, for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Short memory. An incredible, credible, short memory. We're not real sure about this. They had been with him all the way through. They had been with him through the plagues. They had been with him through the Passover. They had been with him when they left in haste. They had been with him again as they stood at the Red Sea. But he's delayed. Maybe he's being fashionably late. We don't like this. Let's make ourselves a god and let's forget about Moses. Let's ditch him and let's make our own god. Verse 2, and Aaron said to them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. Then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat, drink, and rose up to play. Where did we just read that? 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 7. We find an interesting situation here. The people of ancient Israel took the things, the peace offerings, the burnt offerings. Those were, again, peace offerings and burnt offerings were something that God had instituted. But they had mixed it along with the worship of an idol. They had permitted, again, paganism to be mixed with God. They had brought what we refer to as syncretism into the worship of God. That is the mixing of ideologies that is truth and error. And what did they do? Again, as it says there, they drank, they rose up to play, they had a good time. They partied it up. Let's go back here to 1 Corinthians chapter 8. What was the application that Paul was trying to give to the church of God at Corinth? 1 Corinthians chapter 8. what was he trying to get across to them? Again, as I said, we understand what it was that happened with ancient Israel, but then what was the lesson that Paul was trying to give to Corinth? 1 Corinthians chapter 8, notice beginning here in verse 4. There was a situation that occurred here at Corinth where there were those, some would not eat the meat that had been not fully consumed on the altar. They go into the shambles, what's commonly referred to the shambles. It's the marketplace for, again, clean animals that had been sacrificed. It had not been completely burned up. They would take that meat and they would sell it in the marketplace. There were those at the church in Corinth that said, you can't do that. That's meat offered to an idol. There are others that said, no, there's nothing wrong with that. Paul's going to address that here. 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 4, he says, therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and there is no other God but one. So he's like, understand and realize there's only one God. The worship of any other idol is wrong. Verse 9. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? Paul's addressing a couple of things here. First of all, he's saying an idol is nothing, but be careful not to cause others to stumble. In other words, meat that is offered to an idol is nothing if it's not completely burned up. But he says, if someone has a problem with that, don't cause them to stumble. Don't them invite them over to your place. Hey, you want to come over for dinner? What are you having? Well, we've got this roast that we got from the shambles, from the marketplace. It wasn't fully burned up in the temple. We can't eat that. He says, don't make it a stumbling block for other people. While it might not have been wrong to eat meat offered to idols, he's also saying, don't walk into the temple and eat the meat there. Don't participate by simply saying, well, I won't worship in the temple, but I'll go ahead and eat the meat in the temple. The point being here that a Christian can deceive themselves and enter into the worship of an idol if they are not careful. Idol today, again, what's the application for us? Idolatry today finds its way in a different thing. We find it in materialism. We find it in materialism. Let us over in Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3, and notice verse 5. He says, therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. So the idolatry that he was referring to in Corinth was one thing. The application for us today that is idolatry and not becoming an idolater is that we become covetousness of stuff. People today are not bowing down to animals and images of animals. I don't believe for a minute that anybody within earshot of my voice here in this room or in any of the congregations of the Northwest is bowing down to worship an animal. But we all like our stuff, don't we? We like our cars. We like our houses. We like our clothes. Boy, do we love our shoes. We like our stuff. The point being very clear here is there's nothing wrong with stuff. But we can let it become our gods. And when we let it become our gods, we move to the point of covetousness. When we move to the point of covetousness, Paul says here in Colossians 3, verse 5, that is idolatry. So just as Israel had an idol that they worshipped, they had the burnt offerings, they had the peace offerings, but they mixed in the worshiping of a pagan god. Just as, again, the problem that Corinth had with those that would eat meat offered to idols, those that would not eat meat offered to idols, we in the 21st century need to understand, what is the point? We need to be careful not to covet the gods of the 21st century, our stuff. Not wrong to have stuff. I like my stuff. I enjoy my stuff. I'm happy to share my stuff with you. But I don't covet it. I don't love it more than I love God. That is the point where it goes to idolatry. And that's the point that Paul, again, was addressing that we need to understand for us today in the 21st century. Let's go to the third point. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. For you on your device, just poke 1 Corinthians 10 verse 8. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 verse 8. What is the statement that he makes here? What's the third lesson that he's going to give Corinth that goes back to Israel? 1 Corinthians chapter 10 verse 8. He says, "Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell." Well, he's being pretty specific here, right? What event was he talking about here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 8? He's referencing a specific number of people. Let's go to Numbers chapter 25. Numbers chapter 25. Let's begin here in verse 1. Numbers chapter 25 and beginning in verse 1. It says, "Now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel." He saw what was going on. Again, there was a sexual immorality that was going on here. You read about that in verse 1, where there's harlotry that was committed with the women of Moab. God's anger was aroused against Israel. Verse 4, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel.' So Moses said to the judges of Israel, 'Every one of you kill his men who were joined to Baal of Peor.' And indeed, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand. And he went out after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her body. So the plague was stopped among the children of Israel." Verse 9, "And those who died in the plague were 24,000. Uh-oh. We got a problem here. Paul referred to 23,000. You just read in verse 9 here, 24,000. Well, there we go. The Bible can't be trusted. There's an inconsistency here. Well, let's understand something. Paul did not have the use of a concordance like you and I do. He did not have use of commentaries the way you and I have use of commentaries today. He only had the heavy scrolls. There's a couple of things that possibly could have happened. He could have had a lapse of memory that it was 24, not 23. Certain commentaries also point out that it was possibly Phinehas that killed 1,000 people and 23,000 were killed, again, making the 24. The essence of the lesson, brethren, is still the same. Here in Numbers chapter 25, sexual immorality was not treated kindly by God. It end resulted in death of 24,000 people. What was the lesson that Paul was trying to get through to Corinth? Well, you remember I said before that Corinth was a city, a center that was depraved with lustful things. Sexual immorality was extremely evident in Corinth during Paul's writings. In this particular verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 8, where he talks about sexual immorality, let me read Barnes Notes commentary from this one particular verse. It says the following. It says, "It was common at Corinth," talking about sexual immorality. "It was the prevalent vice there. To Corinthianize was a term synonymous among the ancients with licentiousness. So common was this at Corinth that, as we have seen, not less than 1,000 prostitutes were supported in a single temple there. And the city was visited by vast multitudes of foreigners, among other reasons, on account of its facilities for this sin. Christians, therefore, were in a special manner exposed to it, and hence the anxiety of the apostle to warn them against it. They were sitting there at a time in which sexual immorality was rampant, it was legal, it was justified, and they said, everybody do it. Paul is addressing the church at Corinth, and he's saying, hey, just because everybody else is involved in the sexual immorality, just because it is legal in the city, just because everybody does it, you don't do that. He was again trying to show that ancient Israel went through this. They did it, and look how they paid. His point for them was, don't get involved with the sexual climate right now in Corinth. It is wrong. It is not godly. Okay. What's the lesson for us? That's number three. What's the lesson for us in the 21st century? I don't need to tell you that our society is becoming more sexually immoral. Some of the highest hits on websites that exist are on websites dedicated to pornography in the 21st century. Couple that along with not speaking about sexual immorality, it's taboo. We can't talk about same-sex marriage. We can't talk about marital infidelity. That's between those people. We can't talk about living outside of marriage. Those are, again, things that you just don't talk about because it's accepted. We are living at a time in the 21st century that in many respects has much of what we may see in Corinth, maybe to not the same degree in certain respects, but certainly in terms of the smorgasbord of depravity sexually that exists. What do we learn then from that? What's the lesson for us in the 21st century? The lesson is we cannot let the sexual standards around us become our standards. We can become calloused to it over a period of time. We just don't think about it. We sort of think about these things and we just, yeah, okay, whatever. If we're not careful, it infects our thinking and our values. I remember some time back hearing the story of a third generation member of the Church of God. Third generation. And the statement that this individual made when same-sex marriage came up several years ago is, well, what's the big deal if two people love each other? Who cares? And I thought, wow. Wow. Can we not see what the Bible says? Can we not see what the instruction is? My point is that here's a situation in which the standards around us in the 21st century infected that person's thinking. It infected their values. The point for us is we cannot let what happens again with sexual morality and sexual standards in the 21st century affect us. Let's move on to the fourth point. Again, let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and let's pick up our fourth point. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 9. He says, nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Again, he is talking about something specifically here. What is he referring to? Let's go over to Numbers chapter 21. Numbers chapter 21. Numbers chapter 21, and notice we're going to begin in verse 5. We're going to find the serpent on the pole. Let's go through here what it says. Numbers chapter 21, beginning in verse 5. Numbers chapter 21 and verse 5. It says, and the people spoke against God and against Moses, why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread. Once again, we find another reference to the bread. Verse 6, so the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died. Therefore the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, For we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. So Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and it shall be that everyone who is bitten when he looks at it shall live. So Moses made a bronze serpent and put it on a pole, and so it was if a serpent had bitten anyone when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. Now, it's interesting when you take a look at this particular passage, if you've ever seen, I believe it's the American Medical Association. If you see the symbol that they use, it is a pole with a serpent on it. If you wonder where they got that from, you need to know, look no further than Numbers chapter 21. There is nothing new under the sun. Even medical doctors have used something from the Bible to, again, make their case or have their particular symbol. Here we find a situation in which they tried God's patience and it angered God. The tempting of Christ is again tempting God and tempting his patience. Israel was tempting God's patience. We find it very clear there. Now, he did step in and he did deliver them, but they never had to go down that path to begin with. What was Paul referring to? What was it that Paul was referring to? Well, perhaps it was the visiting of temples of the false gods. We've already talked about that a little bit. Now, here we find a people in Corinth that knew what the truth was. They knew that the false temples worshiped false gods. But you get a sense that they wanted to push the boundaries with God and see how far they could push God. They had a sense here that they were, again, what he was talking about was tempting Christ. They were tempting God and tempting his patience. What is the application for us today? Well, do we push the boundaries with God? Do we have one foot in and one foot out? God's expectation for us is 100% full and complete commitment. As was stated in the sermonette, if you are not committed, if you are not moving forward, then you are stagnant and actually moving backwards over a period of time. Satan's temptation of telling Christ, again in Matthew chapter 4, to cast yourself down. What was Jesus Christ's response when he was tempted by Satan in the wilderness? He said, don't tempt God. Israel pushed God. Corinth, the church of God at Corinth, there were those that were pushing God. How far can we go? We can kind of enter into the temple. Maybe we don't worship that false idol, but we're going into the temple because all our friends are there. One foot in, one foot out. What's the lesson for us in the 21st century? We don't want to see how far we can push God. We never want to see how far we can push God. We find that Israel tried to push God repeatedly. We find again here that evidently it was a problem in Corinth, and we find that even in the 21st century, people will try to push God. We don't want to be there. We don't want to see how far we can go. We don't want to see if God will push out the way up to that boundary, would walk right up to that line and kind of lean over the line. Stay away from the line. Don't go up to that line. We don't ever want to push God. So again, that's the fourth point that we get back to, again, that Paul was addressing. Don't see how far you can push God. Let's go back for number five, the last one here. Back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And verse 10. He talked in verse 9 about not tempting Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by the serpents. Here in verse 10, we find the fifth example that he goes to. He says, nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. The complaining goes back to nothing more than what we always remember and what I spoke about a year ago, if you recall, and that was the sin of murmuring. Israel was great. If they were great at anything, it was great at murmuring. In one particular sense here, you're asking the question, what was the complaint about? Well, we're going to see in a moment that it really was speaking out against those who were appointed by God. Now, it happened multiple times in Israel, but the murmuring and the complaining goes back to a specific instance here that we're going to visit. Let's go over to Numbers chapter 14. In Numbers chapter 14, we're actually coming to the tail end of the event. And the tail end of the event is when God had asked them again to gather together the spies, the 12 spies, to spy out the land. They were right on the edge of the promised land. He says, choose those 12 men that they will go out and bring back a report to the rest of the people. In other words, I've told you this. Send these 12 eyewitnesses out. Let them come back and give the eyewitness report and let them tell you in their own words that it's everything that I told you it was to be. Here we're going to find a situation here where the murmuring begins. We find that again those 12 came back. They again talked about what it was, and the 10 gave the bad report, and they simply stated, yeah, it was a land just like he said it was, but by the way, he didn't mention there were giants in the land. He didn't mention that these guys were bigger than NFL linebackers and NFL linemen, and they could just destroy us, and there's no way that we're able to survive. We can't beat them. We can't enter that land. We'll be killed. He didn't mention that. They gave the bad report. End result, the people began to weep. The people began to say, oh, we need to go back to Egypt. We need to go back to the melons, the cucumbers, the leeks, the garlic, the onions. We need to go back to three hots and a cot. We need to go back to slavery. They didn't say slavery, but that's what it was. We need to go back to sin. We're right on the edge of it. But let's reverse course and go back. Numbers chapter 14, and beginning in verse 1. So they began to murmur. So all the congregation lifted up their voices and wept, and the people wept that night, and all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. So they're murmuring and they're complaining again with Moses and Aaron. Who had put Moses and Aaron in charge? God had put them in charge. So who were they murmuring against? Who were they complaining to? They're complaining to God. They thought they were complaining to Moses and Aaron. It shows the short-sightedness of them. Because ultimately they were complaining about God because God had put them in charge. Verse 3, why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword? That our wives and children should become victims, would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? It's a rhetorical question in their mind. There's no question to be had here. It would be better for us to go back to Egypt. They wanted to select a leader. Let's go back. Forget it. Moses and Aaron step in. They try to step in and say, no, wait a minute. We find two individuals, the two spies, Joshua and Caleb. Verse 6, Joshua the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, the land we pass through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. And all the congregation said to stone them with stones. They were only doing what God had told them to do, enter into the promised land. Have faith. Don't worry about the obstacles. They made it clear. They said, God's told us he's promised us the land. It doesn't matter who's standing in our way. We can do this. Verse 10, you see what's coming. All the congregation said to stone them with stones. Now the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of meeting before all the children of Israel. This was a thing in which they literally were prepared to stone Caleb and Joshua to death. For what? For standing up for God, for having faith in God. The congregation had murmured. The 10 spies had murmured. Remember the number of people. So this murmuring became louder and louder and louder. And as you see there, by the time they wept all night, they came probably in the next morning and said, let's get out of here. Murmur. It was a dull roar that became a loud shout. They didn't want to hear what Joshua and Caleb had to say. Grab the stones, let's kill them. They're standing between us and going back where safety is, or what they thought was safety. Let's drop down to verse 22. Because all these men, this is when God it angered him over what had happened. He said, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice. Wasn't the first time God had been tested by them. They had murmured over and over and over again. And they certainly shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of them who rejected me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, he didn't murmur, he didn't complain, he didn't tempt me. I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it. There's a different spirit there with Caleb and with Joshua by extension. A different attitude. The people allowed the negative reports to unravel their reliance in God. The murmuring had gotten to them. We have to come back to understand the central point for ancient Israel. They were insinuating that God did not know what he was doing. God, we don't think you know what you're doing. Therefore, we're reversing course and we're going back. What was it that Paul was talking about with regards to Corinth? What was the murmuring that he was having to deal with at Corinth? Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. We've seen what ancient Israel was contending with based upon what Paul talked about. What was the lesson that Paul was trying to get through to Corinth? 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and notice verse 11. He says, for it's been declared to me concerning you, my brethren, by those of Chloe's household, that there are contentions among you. He references Chloe, and I'm sure he does that for, again, validity. This is not just some person who's a gossip, a busybody. They had to know this person. So when he says Chloe, they're like, oh, this is for someone who's got a reputation. What they speak is the truth. Those of Chloe's household, that there are contentions among you. Now I say this, that each of you says, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, or I am of Cephas or Peter, and I am of Christ. He was talking about a division that existed. There was murmuring going on. Over what? Over the leadership that was there. I reject who baptized you. I reject who baptized you. I reject who baptized you. There was murmuring going on. It was a different instance than ancient Israel, but the overlying principle was the same. It was murmuring and complaining. Verse 17. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with words of wisdom, lest the cross of Christ should be of no effect. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. You know, you go back to the letters that Paul wrote, and he made it perfectly clear to them that he was not the most polished speaker. He was not the most eloquent speaker. And again, the Greeks loved their orators. Get up and revile them. They would have loved Paul Harvey back in the day, right? Now, brethren, the rest of the story, right? Paul wasn't that type of person. His letters were meaty. He was the king of the run-on sentence, but that's another story of him by itself. He was not the most polished speaker, but he was speaking the truth to them. He was speaking the truth to them. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 10. He says, nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. So what was it that Paul was talking about? They were complaining about Paul and his speaking. Oh, he's weak. His letters are powerful, but when we see him in person, he's weak. They weren't talking about his physical. They were talking about the fact that he's a weak speaker. That's what they were referencing. And they were, in some cases, questioning whether he truly was an apostle. That's how far the murmuring had gone. What's the modern application? We saw what it was for ancient Israel. We saw what it was for the church of God at Corinth. What is the modern application for us today? Notice 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Second Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 24. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 24. One simple verse here. 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 24. He says, "Not that we have dominion over your faith, but are fellow workers for your joy, for by faith you stand." What is the modern application? There is no minister that has dominion over your faith. I have no dominion over your faith. What I attempt to do by preaching to you every Sabbath and every holy day, and by extension if I visit with you and counsel with you, I strive as best I can to build up your faith. But just as ministers work to build up your faith, we also understand they are human. And they make mistakes. Ask my wife, she will tell you the list of my mistakes. No, she's good, she won't do that. We all make mistakes. Ministers are no different. But we come back to understand is that we do not have dominion over your faith. What is the modern application of this fifth point? Brethren, if we see faults in men, do not disparage God. I was ordained to the ministry of Jesus Christ. I had hands laid upon me, just as every other minister has hands laid upon them. We must be careful when we see mistakes and faults in men, not to disparage God by extension. Are there bound to be mistakes? Sure. You make mistakes, I make mistakes. You apologize for yours, I apologize for mine. But we have to be careful not to disparage God by taking it to another extension. That is what Corinth was doing. They were disparaging Paul and literally saying, is he even truly an apostle? Should he even be an apostle? This is, again, we come back to understand what was being stated. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Let's begin to wrap this up now. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we've gone through the five instances here. Here in verse 13, he makes a statement here, and there are three elements that I want us to understand. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. He says, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." Paul's saying three things in this verse, and they all apply to the five lessons that I've given you this afternoon. Number one, he's making the statement that all will be tempted. That's common to all of us. No one is immune from it. From the time of ancient Israel to the time of the 21st century today, human nature has not changed. They were walking to the promised land. We drive our cars, but figuratively speaking, we're still walking to the kingdom of God. Human nature has not changed. Number two. God will not tempt you past what you are able. That's the second statement he's making here in verse 13. Who will not tempt you past what you are able? We can overcome. Part of the lesson these days of unleavened bread is, regardless of the understanding and realization that sin is everywhere, is that if we are committed to overcoming, we can overcome it. And number three, God will make a way of escape. Sometimes that way of escape means giving us a way to bear it. We often think of an escape of, well, give me a hatch, give me a door, give me a window to climb out of. But oftentimes God says, uh-uh. I'm going to help you escape it by giving you the ability to bear it. That's a way to escape. It may not be the way that we like, but it's the way we have to learn. It's the way we have to learn. So how do we deal with what we've reviewed here in 1 Corinthians chapter 10? Let's go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. We'll go from 1 Corinthians 10 to 2 Corinthians 10. How's that? 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5. Here is the statement that is made. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5. He says, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Do you know what common denominator all five of those lessons that ancient Israel went through? Do you know what common denominator Paul was talking about to the church of God in Corinth? Do you know what common denominator that has for us in the 21st century? Those five lessons, those five incidents, they all started with a thought. The thought sparked an action. That action reaped a bad result. Don't think the thought. If you don't think the thought, we don't spark the action. If we don't spark the action, we don't reap an end result or a bad result. Let's conclude by turning over to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4, and notice verse 7. Actually, let's begin in verse 6. Philippians chapter 6. He says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. Verse 7 is the one I want to key on as we conclude. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Brethren, what is the overall lesson of what we've gone through? These examples were written for our admonition. What is the admonition? The Israelites, several of them, lost out on the promised land. The bad news is, if we falter, and if we follow them, we will lose out on our promised land, the kingdom of God. But the good news is, that doesn't need to happen. Because these things were written for our admonition. Why? For what reason? What are we to learn? They want us and they need us and they show us that we must guard ourselves very closely and very carefully as we move forward at sundown this evening from these days of unleavened bread.